November 7th, 1972, and at Groningen, we're interviewing Jean Lecoeur about early days of French radio astronomy. Well, now, you said that French radio astronomy began in 1947, actually.
About 47, 48, but I became aware of radio astronomy. I had contacts with the people there in 53. Actually, I did some research as a student in 54. And after that, I had to finish my studies and do my military service, and I came back to the group in January 59.
This is the group at Meudon.
The group at Meudon. So in fact, initially the group wasn't at Meudon. It was connected with the physics laboratory in the École Normale Supérieure, and the origin of the group comes from the interest of Professor Rocard, who is still the head of the lab. He was the head of the lab at this time. And he's still the head of the lab.
I see.
And Professor Rocard has put his hand on some Würzburg radars. You know, you had some in the Netherlands too. And he had, as far as I remember, three or four of these Würzburg.
What was his background?
Oh, this came from Germany.
His background was he.
Rocard is a physicist. He's a physicist, an acoustician. He has nothing to.
I see.
He has never been directly connected with research in radio astronomy. But he has a strong interest in that, and he wanted to use his radars, and an obvious way was to use them for radio astronomy. Mm-hmm. And he had a few people who became interested. I think the three founders of the group were Denis has a physics background. He's mostly interested in plasma physics.
Mm-hmm.
So he wasn't in electronic engineers. And the two others, Jacques-Émile Blum and Steinberg,
yeah.
Those two people were radio engineers at the beginning. Blum, I think, has worked for the French Navy for some time. And they set up a very, very small group, all three together. And after that, two other people joined them, Boischaud, who is still active in radio astronomy in Meudon,
right.
And Leroux. Leroux was a very funny man. He's one of the most strange person I have met. He was a complete autodidact. He has been at the university, but he had no contact with research before he came by chance to Paris, to visit Paris. He's from Brittany.
I see.
And quite remote, he is in quite remote place of Brittany, and his parents were selling hats in some very remote place. So he came to visit the lab by chance, and he came very interested in what was done there, and with Steinberg or Blum, I don't remember, I wasn't there at the time, asked them to join them for some research student, and they even told him that he could be paid a bit. Oh, I would do that and I would be paid. He was very fascinated.
So the idea of being paid.
The idea of being paid for doing something interesting never crossed him. And he has been extremely good, both as a theoretician and he was one of the first to work on the theory of synchrotron radiation, and he was actually the one to give the first to give the formulae for synchrotron self-absorption. And he has been also very active in building receivers, but he was his largest activity was a theory of the electron of elementary particles, and but he never succeeded in doing anything in that direction. You know, other people have taken a lot of time for doing that, but they have never succeeded. And he has disappeared. Now he's teaching physics in the University of Rennes. He's no more connected with radio astronomy.
And his name was Leroux.
Leroux, L-E-R-R-O-U-X.
Right.
So he's one of the founders who has disappeared, but the four other people are still active in radio astronomy.
Now this first group, where did they get their inspiration get interested in radio astronomy? Was it from...
Well, I think that they have been, at the very beginning, contacts with other people doing radio astronomy abroad. I think mostly of Christiansen. Christiansen is a personal friend of Steinberg.
I see.
And I think they have received some help. Of course, at the time there was nearly no question to do anything but solar radio astronomy. And they started with a very small instrument on the roof of the laboratory, And after that, they had this was in Paris. École Normale Supérieure is in Paris, very close to the Panthéon.
I see.
And there was no connection with astronomy at the time, with the conventional astronomers at this time. And
was this a Würzburg dish?
No, there was a small dish, and after that, the two Würzburg were set up on the altazimuth mount, and they started to do solar radio astronomy with that. And then I found this sort of situation with about five or six people when I came in 53, when I was a student. And in 54, I made with Denis and Leroux the first non-solar observation in the staff. This was mapping the galaxy at 33 centimeters in the continuum.
I see.
This was quite an experience because observations were not as easy in those times as they are now. You know, have an altazimuth mount and we had to draw conversion. We have no computer, to draw by hand conversion charts for coordinates. And every half minute you have to set up the telescope to the right position and so on. So that was rather painful.
Right.
I remember also being measuring refraction by observing the sun setting and rising, and it was terribly cold. You have to be outside in very uncomfortable position, looking to the sun in a optical telescope, and when the sun crossed the wires. Then you press a button and you have a mark on the chart recorder.
I see.
So we measure the refraction that way. You know, that was rather funny.
But now this was around 54.
This was around 54.
And where was this published? This survey?
Oh, this was published in Compte Rendu de l'Académie des Sciences. This was the only scientific journal in France at the time. There was also some.
Annales d'Astrophysique?
No, Annales d'Astrophysique. It did not exist, I think, at the time.
I see.
I think not. I don't know. It's better check. I'm not sure. But you know, we were not connected with astronomy at the time, not at all.
I see. More physicists.
But at this time, the lab grew. The physics lab which housed us grew, and we thought that it would be time to join. True astronomers, you know. And in fact, that was about the time when we moved to Meudon Observatory. And here, the director of the Paris and Meudon Observatory at the time was Professor Danjon. He was a fundamental astronomer. But he was very clever, and he understood at once the interest of radio astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
So he made he really helped us quite a lot, and so we moved because there was not enough room in Paris, and we moved to Meudon because there were new buildings available there.
Right, and the optical people were already at Meudon?
Yes, there were optical people at Meudon doing mostly solar astronomy since 1880 or so. So this was a long-standing observatory.
So we joined
the other. And as far as I remember, we had very good contact with those optical people. You know, this has not always been the case in the history of radio astronomy. You know, sometimes there was some misunderstanding between optical and radio astronomer, but that was not the case, thanks to Danjon, who was a very, very clever man.
Well, let me ask about the two Würzburg dishes. They were used as an interferometer?
No. We had two. They were working on different frequencies. The first was was used for solar observation at a relatively low frequency, I don't remember, meter wavelengths or something. And the second one was used for first solar and then galactic radio astronomy at 33 centimeters.
Yeah, I see.
We had mixers which were quite good at the time. The noise temperature was about 700 degrees, which was quite nice for the time, yeah. And at about this time, actually it was a bit earlier, the radio astronomers decided that the site near Paris, the two Würzburg were no more in Paris, it was about 20 kilometers south of Paris, in a strawberry field. That's interesting for interesting place to observe. Well, at about this time, actually I think the first step was taken in 52, we decided that I wasn't connected with the crew, but the people who were there decided that they would better have an observing station far from Paris, because they were already frightened by the problem of interference. Interference
right.
were becoming already serious at this time.
Right.
And as so the École Normale Supérieure, the who belong to whom the physics lab which housed us decided to purchase a piece of land at Nancy, 200 kilometers south of Paris. And this was purchased in 52. And a major activity of the group was to build a new instruments for Nancy. And the first instrument, the first important instrument which was built, was a solar interferometer. This was a 32-element east-west interferometer working on 169 megacycle. And this instrument has been very successful. It was put into operation in 56, as far as I remember. And it has been very successful. They discovered the type 4 burst, solar burst, with this instrument.
Who worked with that instrument primarily?
Bloom and Boischot, mainly. And plus, now the group in 56, the group was much bigger, I think about 25 or 30 people at the time. And so they were very active in solar radio astronomy, and about this time they have also set up a 3-centimeter multi-element interferometer with 16 antennas. And those two instruments still exist, and they are still working now at Nancy.
Hmm.
And there were a number of improvements. But you see, most of the activity was purely solar. The first exception was this work I did with Denis and Leroux on this mapping the galactic plane, mapping the galaxy at 33 centimeters. And after Mohan Joshi, who is now in Bombay, in Tata Institute, he observed a position of radio influxes of radio sources using the solar interferometer, which was sensitive enough to detect perhaps a few hundred sources. And in the meantime, another instrument was set up at Nancy for non-solar astronomy. This is an instrument which used two of the Würzburgs, which were previously used for other purposes.
The same two?
No, they were not the same two. They were the third. Oh, it's a complicated story. I think from the two Würzburg that we used initially, one stayed on the spot, and another one moved to Nancy. And there were two other Würzburg available, and one has been moved to Meudon for another group of radio astronomy, very small group headed by Laffineur. And we had this fourth one at Nancy, so we used one of the original Würzburg plus another one. And with that we built an interferometer. These Würzburg were mounted on an equatorial mount, homemade, and with that I started operation at the time I came back. Most of the electronics was done by Leroux, and I did my thesis with that. This was observation of structure of radio sources.
You say when you came back?
When I came back after my military service.
Oh, after your military service.
I told you before that there was a gap. There was a gap in my work between 55 and 59, mostly due to military service. So I started to work that, and now it's sort of modern history, so you would find what happens in old books after that.
After the, why were the Würzburgs so popular even at that late date?
Well, I think they were very good antennas, you know, a very good construction, and they could easily be dismantled into reasonably sized panels,
right.
I think a few meters. And they were very good antennas.
Very portable.
7 meters in diameter, and the surface accuracy was quite good, still at 21 centimeter. And the mesh was good for 21 centimeter too. I think it could have been used up to, say, 15 centimeter with some work.
Mm-hmm.
And they were rather light, so mostly aluminum building.
It's just interesting how many different groups used these.
Yes, poor, but there was quite a lot.
Yeah.
The Germans built an enormous number, probably 100 or so.
Hmm.
And they were scattered around Europe. There were many in France, mostly on the Atlantic coast. There were some in the Netherlands too, some in Belgium, and and a number of in Germany also. Right. They were the long range radars used, I think, on decimetric wavelengths at the time.
And the English took a couple back with them, I think.
Yeah, so most of the people
took several over.
Actually, we also took from Germany some pieces of electronics which were very useful at the beginning. So pieces of electronics which were part of the radars.
Yeah,
this was very advanced.
Local oscillators
system.
And
yes, this
like
was
this.
A very, very advanced system for the time. You know,
Well, I suppose this was especially important for a country like France or Holland that was occupied. And I mean, the English and the Americans were developing their own radar systems. But
yes, but we couldn't. So actually, no one was involved in radar studies in France because it
right.
was just impossible. In Great Britain, the situation was quite different because
right.
A number of people who are now doing radio astronomy, like Hay, for example, they were radar
right.
people. And most of the Australians, like John Bolton and Gordon Stanley, all these people were first
right,
radar engineers.
Right. See, I thought of another question. You mentioned these solar interferometers at Nancy
mm-hmm.
with many elements. I was just wondering where the development of that came from. Was that?
I think the prototype of all the interferometers was Christiansen's instrument in Fleurs.
That's what it sounded like to me. I just wanted to verify.
Yes, this instrument still exists. You know, it has been improved recently
right.
by they added a number of antennas.
Right.
But this instrument was completed before the Nancy 1. And I guess, I haven't been very much involved in the building of this instrument, but I guess there have been a constant exchange of information between Sydney and, between Fleurs and France.
Mm-hmm.
We had permanent contact with
yeah.
Christiansen at this time. You know, and but the French won the several new developments. For example, we had the first multi-beam system for the north-south arm, because we after this east-west arm, which was completed in 56, we had the north-south arm completed, I think, in 58, and this one has a multi-beam system.
I
about 15 simultaneous beam in deck.
You think that was the first time that was?
That was the first time, and this was mostly Bloom's work.
Mm-hmm.
And Bloom's had always been developing new instrumentation, and he was also the inventor of the correlation receiver. I mean, not the autocorrelation receiver, but the correlation receiver, which came much before.
For an interferometer.
For interferometer, well, and he was the first to. I think he was the first to develop correlators. Interferometry, yes, and he had the idea of having a correlation receiver in which you divide the signal at the input in a magic T, and then you have two independent receivers, and then you correlate the output. So this eliminates the zero, the DC component.
Oh, yeah.
And all the receivers at Nancy are.
That was Bloom.
Yeah, that was Bloom.
So I should definitely talk to him about that sort of.
Yeah, because he has a lot of. Yeah, it would be very important to contact him for the history of
yeah.
Early instrumentation in radio astronomy. And actually, he was the first to have the idea of the autocorrelation receiver, the sort of thing that Weinreb has
right.
Sandy Weinreb has developed later. But this was published, but unfortunately, we have never done anything practical.
Never got involved in it.
Yeah. We haven't done a line observation at all before the Nancy radio telescope
was
completed.
First time.
That was the first time. You know, everything was continuum.
And the Nancy dish was what? When was that completed?
Well, the first part was completed in 64.
Yeah.
And it was entirely completed and working in 68. So 4 years from now only.
Hmm.
It's relatively late. Most people imagine that it was completed much before, but that wasn't true.
Yeah. And, well, if I can just take the history a little bit later, up till the Nancy dish, that seems like a good break-off point.
Okay.
Now, you say you did your thesis on structure of radio sources
yeah.
using this two-element interferometer. And was that movable?
Yes,
one
yes.
element movable?
Actually, it was the largest movable interferometer at this time. You know, at this time, there were three groups working on interferometry. And we were actually more or less the pioneers in the field. I think the first one to do interferometry successfully was Jennison. Jennison in Jordan Bank, he had a small interferometer working on 10 centimeters, and this he published the first visibility curve of Cygnus A and Cas A, and this was in 1957 or something like that. And after that, there were three interferometers which were completed about the same time, one in Caltech, which is still which exists still now. And another one, use the Mark I telescope in Jodrell Bank, plus a remote antenna. And this was used by Palmer and collaborators.
Malvern.
No. This wasn't. This was purely Jodrell. There was no link.
Oh no, the Malvern was the.
No, the interferometry with Malvern is much later.
The microwave link, right? That's later.
Yeah, it was much later. But they had a microwave link between Mark I and Jodrell, plus another telescope in a remote station, and they had a pretty good resolving power, but not terribly good sensitivity with this instrument. And our instrument had a baseline of 1.5 kilometers east-west and about 400 meters north-south. It wasn't very powerful in sensitivity because the dishes were very small. So we have an integrating device. We are able to integrate the fringes up to about 1 hour total.
See.
So this was a very elaborated, very sophisticated device for the time for integrating phase integration.
Right.
But we had never succeeded having phase measurements because the phase stability wasn't very good. But Moffett at Caltech, he had much bigger antennas and he has a phase stability, but the resolution was much smaller, about a factor of two smaller than ours. So all three groups competed together at the same time. That was rather fun.
Spurred each other on, and well, it sounds like you were getting complementary information also.
Yes, this was rather well complementary. Yes, for example,
you had to resort to models, I suppose, for your sources.
We had result rather detailed results on bright sources. I think we were the first to see the point source at the center of the Virgo A, for example. And we had this information about the halo, and we saw that the halo was elongated, and we had comparison with the Caltech on this point, for example. That was the sort of thing we are doing.
And which years was this that you're talking about now? Which years?
Oh, this was between 59 and 62. I had my degree at the end of 62, and then I kept doing interferometric observation up to the end of 63. I think M82 was the last object. But this was really the limit of sensitivity of the telescope. I had observed about 40 sources total, but after we were killed by the lack of sensitivity of the instrument, and the instrument has been abandoned.
Still with the Wurzburg dishes. That's probably the latest observations that were done with them. Serious observations.
Oh no, I think Kodvec has observed much later, not?
Then 63?
Oh, 63 was still in use, no?
I don't know.
Well, Dwingelow was up at this time.
Yeah, the big telescope in Dwingelow was up in 58 or so.
Yeah, but I think they kept doing some things.
I'll have to ask about that.
But I'm not sure. You'd better ask.
But anyway, it was used at Meudon, Annonce.
Yeah, Annonce, we use them up to
63 or so.
And now they are no more in use.
Now, were there any other instruments there before the big telescope?
No, we had all solar instruments, and that was all. We were thinking of a interferometer with two 25-meter dishes at the same time than Caltech, but we had no money, and we were obliged to confine only on two 7 meters. And I think that was a big shame for the French radio astronomy, because we could have done a lot of things.
Yeah.
There have been a sort of gap in the observing work between the end of my observation in 63 and the beginning of operation of the big radio telescope. Most people were involved in the building and they weren't doing many observing. And at this time there was a sort of crisis in the lab because people were tired to build and build equipment and not doing observation. And this, after that, in fact, I was sort of disgusted of radio astronomy. I turned to infrared for a few years.
To what?
To infrared astronomy
for a few years.
And Steinberg left. Steinberg left the group and is now heading a space radio astronomy group, very successfully. He's still in Meudon, but he's no more connected with ground-based radio astronomy. You know, so these were two things which happened.
I'd like to ask the building of the the big telescope in 64 to 68. It seems like several of the large telescopes that were built in that era had various difficulties in the building. Did this one go smoothly, or?
No, our main difficulty is that we had only one engineer, a mechanical engineer.
Only one mechanical engineer.
One mechanical engineer. All the rest we have to do by ourselves. And I spent several people spend a number of hours of designing equipment.
It wasn't done by an outside contractor.
No, we had an outside contractor, but it wasn't. It was very good for mechanical building, but for the rest, we have to do everything by ourselves. For example, the pointing of the plane mirrors and the tracking of the focus were entirely conceived by ourselves, by Steinberg and by myself. And it was realized by Ferranti in Edinburgh, but we spent a lot, 1 or 2 years, thinking on making measurements on the surface and so on to have that working.
And all this took longer than you thought it would, I suppose.
Sorry?
All of this took longer than you thought it would originally.
Yes, it took a very long time, and we were somewhat tired to do job. Well, there's something that scientists must do, of course, but we were not prepared to do all that sort of thing.
Right.
You know, and that's one of the reasons of this sort of crisis we had these
years.
Yeah. Well, now I think everything over, the results are coming, and now the situation is good again. And I turned back to radio astronomy. You know?
One last question. Is there any other radio astronomy in France besides the Médon group?
There have been a small group headed by Laffineur. And this was connected with the Institut d'Astrophysique in Paris. And they had an instrument in Haute-Provence Observatory, in the grounds of Haute-Provence Observatory. Mm-hmm. This was the interferometer with two cylindrical parabolic cylinders.
Yeah.
And they made a survey of...
What era? What time was this?
It lasts for very long. I have the feeling that they started in 57 or so, or perhaps even earlier. But they haven't done very many things with that. You know, there were only two or three people, and now the thing is abandoned.
I see. So was there anything published on that?
I don't think... Maybe they have published a few results, but it didn't make any noise anyway.
Right.
Things justified.
And has there been any other groups?
No, that was all. And now there is another group in Bordeaux Observatory.
Right, for the millimeter.
For the millimeter instrument, but that's an emanation of the Meudon group. You know.
But that's a very modern development.
Yes, that's very recent.
Yeah.
3 years only, about.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Finishes the interview with James LeCure on 7 November 1972, the day that undoubtedly Tricky Dicky is going to get a second term over McGovern. Although it's now 4 p.m. here, and that's 9 a.m. on the east coast of the U.S. The polls are only been open a couple hours. Obviously, I should visit Mendon and talk to Boischot, Bloom, and Steinberg, but that ends it for now. This is the end of the tape, this side of the tape.